swayed for a moment, and exploded. Smeared with grease and ichor, Ortiz scrambled up out of his hatch. He was suddenly aware of a whole new layer of gunfire, sustained lasgun blasts, the chatter of support weapons, the crump of grenades. Another force was moving out of the woods, crushing the Chaos Marine ambush hard against the steel flanks of his artillery machines. As Ortiz watched, the remaining World Eaters died. One was punctured dozens of times by lasgun fire and fell face down into the mire. Another was flamed repeatedly as he ripped apart the wreck of a basilisk with his steel hands. The flames touched off the tank's magazine, and the Marine was incinerated with his victims. His hideous roar lingered long after the white-hot flames had consumed him. The column's saviors emerged from the forest around them. Imperial guards, tall, dark-haired, pale-skinned men in black fatigues, a scruffy, straggle-haired mob, almost invisible in their patterned camo cloaks. Ortiz heard strange, disturbing pipe music strike up a banshee wail in the close forest, and a victory yelp erupted from the men. It was met by cheers and whoops from his own crews. Ortiz leapt down into the mud and approached the Imperial Guardsman through the drifting smoke.
"I am Colonel Ortiz. You boys have my earnest thanks," he said. "Who are you?"
The nearest man, a giant with unruly black hair, a tangled braided beard, and thick, bare arms decorated with blue spiral tattoos, smiled jauntily and saluted, bringing up his lasgun.
"Colonel Korbeck, Tanith First and Only. Our pleasure, I'm sure."
Ortiz nodded back. He found he was still shaking. He could barely bring himself to look down at the dead Chaos Marine, sprawled in the mud nearby.
"Takes discipline to ambush an ambush. Your men certainly know stealth. Why is—"
He got no further. The bearded giant, Korbeck, suddenly froze, a look of dismay on his face. Then he was leaping forward with a cry, tackling Ortiz down into the blue-black mud. The dead World Eater lifted his horned skull out of the muck and half-raised his bolter. But that was all. Then a shrieking chainsword decapitated him. The heavy, dead parts flopped back into the mud. One of them rolled. Ibram Gaunt brandished with his keening chainsword like a duelist and then thumbed it to idle. He turned to Korbeck and Ortiz as they got up, caked in black filth. Ortiz stared at the tall, powerful man in the long, dark coat and cap of an Imperial Commissar. His face was blade-thin, his eyes as dark as space. He looked like he could rip a world asunder with his hands.
"Meet the boss," Korbeck chuckled at Ortiz's side.
"Colonel Commissar Gaunt."
Ortiz nodded, wiping his face.
"So, you are Gaunt's ghosts."
Major Gilbert poured himself a brandy from the decanter on the teak stand.
"Just who the hell are these awful barbarian scum?"
he asked, sipping from the huge crystal balloon. At his desk, General Notches Sturm put down his pen and sat back.
"Oh, please, help yourself to my brandy, Gilbert," he muttered,
though the sarcasm was lost on his massive aide. Gilbert reclined on a chaise beside the flickering amber displays of the message caster and gazed at his commander.
"Ghosts? That's what they call them, isn't it?"
Sturm nodded, observing his senior adjutant. Gilbert, Gisham Danver de Banzi Haight Gilbert, to give him his full name, was the second son of the Haight Gilberts of Solenhofen, the royal house of Volpone. He was nearly 2.5 meters tall and arrogantly powerful, with the big, blunt, bland features and languid hooded eyes of the aristocracy. Gilbert wore the grey and gold uniform of the Royal Volpone 50th, the so-called Blue Bloods, who believed they were the noblest regiment in the Imperial Guard. Sturm sat back in his chair.
"They are indeed called ghosts. Gaunt's ghosts, and they're here because I requested them."
Gilbert cocked a disdainful eyebrow.
"You requested them?"
"We've had nigh on 6 weeks, and we can't shake the enemy from Voltus City. They command everything west of the Bacore Valley. Warmaster Makaroth is not pleased. All the while they hold Voltaman, they have a road into the heart of the Sabbat Worlds. So, you see, I need a lever. I need to introduce a new element to break our deadlock."
"That rabble?"
Gilbert sneered.
I watched them as they mustered after the dropships landed them, hairy, illiterate primitives, with tattoos and nose rings.
Sturm lifted a data slate from his desktop and shook it at Gilbert.
Have you read the reports General Hadrach filed after the Sloker took Blackshard? He credits Gaunt's mob with the decisive incursion. It seems they excel at stealth raids.
Sturm got to his feet and adjusted the sit of his resplendent blue blood staff uniform. The study was bathed in yellow sunlight that streamed in through the conservatory doors at the end, softened by net drapes. He rested his hand on the antique globe of Voltamand in its mahogany stand by the desk and span it idly, gazing out across the grounds of Vortimore House. This place had been the country seat of one of Voltamand's most honoured noble families, a vast grey manse, fringed with mauve climbing plants, situated in ornamental parkland 30 kilometres south of Voltis City. It had been an ideal location to establish his supreme headquarters. Outside, on the lawn, a squad of blue-blood elite in full battle dress were executing a precision-synchronized drill with chainswords. Metal flashed and whirled, perfect and poised. Beyond them, a garden of trellises and arbors led down to a boating lake, calm and smoky in the afternoon light. Navigation lights flashed slowly on the barbed masts of the communications array in the herbarium. Somewhere in the stable block, strutting gourd cocks whooped and called. You wouldn't think there was a war on, mused Sturm. He wondered where the previous owners of the manse were now. Did they make it off-world before the first assault? Are they huddled and starving in the belly hold of a refugee ship, reduced overnight to a level with their former vassals? Or are they bone ash in the ruins of Kostorf, or on the burning Metis Road? Or did they die screaming and melting at the orbital port when the legions of chaos first fell on their world, vaporized with the very ships they struggled to escape in? Who cares? Thought Sturm. The war is all that matters. The glory. The crusade. The emperor. He would only care for the fallen when the bloody head of Chanthar, demagogue of the chaos army that held Voltis Citadel, was served up to him on a carving dish. And even then, he wouldn't care much. Gilbert was on his feet, refilling his glass.
This Gaunt is quite a fellow, isn't he? Wasn't he with the Hyrcan Eighth?
Sturm cleared his throat.
Led them to victory at Balhaut. One of old Slado's chosen favourites. Made him a colonel commissar, no less. It was decided he had the prestige to hammer a new regiment or two into shape, so they sent him to the planet Tanith to supervise the founding there. A chaos space fleet hit the world that very night, and he got out with just a few thousand men.
Gilbert nodded.
That's what I heard. Skin of his teeth. But that's his career in tatters. Stuck with an understrength rabble like that. Makaroth won't transfer him, will he?
Sturm managed a small smile.
Our beloved overlord does not look kindly on the favourites of his predecessor, especially as Slado granted Gaunt and a handful of others the settlement rights of the first world they conquered. He and his Tanith rabble are an embarrassment to the new regime. But that serves us well. They will fight hard because they have everything to prove and everything to win.
I say, said Gilbert suddenly, lowering his glass, what if they do win? I mean, if they're as useful as you say.
They will facilitate our victory,
Sturm said, pouring himself a drink.
They will not achieve anything else. We will serve Lord Makaroth twofold. By taking this world for him, and ridding him of Gaunt and his damn ghosts.
You were expecting us? Gaunt asked, riding on the top of Ortiz's basilisk as the convoy moved on. Colonel Ortiz nodded, leaning back against the raised top hatch cover.
We were ordered up the line last night to dig in at the north end of the Bokore Valley and pound the enemy fortifications on the western side. Soften them up, I suppose. En route, I got coded orders sent, telling us to meet your regiment at Pavis Crossroads and transport you as we advanced.
Gaunt removed his cap and ran a hand through his short, fair hair.
We were ordered across country to the crossroads, all right, he responded.
told to meet transport there for the next leg. But my scouts picked up the World Eater's stench, so we doubled back and met you early. Ortiz shuddered.
Good thing for us.
Gaunt gazed along the line of the convoy as they moved on, taking in the massive bulk of the basilisks as they ground up the snaking mud track through the sickly, dim forest. His men were riding on the flanks of the great war machines, a dozen or more per vehicle, joking with the serpent crews, exchanging drinks and smokes, some cleaning weapons, or even snoozing as the lurch of the metal beasts allowed.
So, Storm's sending you in?
Ortiz asked presently.
Right down the river's floodplain, to the gates of Voltis. He thinks we can take the city where 50,000 of his blue bloods have failed.
Can you?
We'll see, Gaunt said, without the flicker of a smile. The ghosts are new, unproven, but for a skirmish on Blackshard. But they have certain strengths.
He fell silent, and seemed to be admiring the gold and turquoise lines of the feather serpent design painted on the barrel of the basilisk's main weapon. Its open beak was the muzzle. All the Quetzalcoatl machines were rich with similar decorations. Ortiz whistled low to himself.
Down the Bacore Valley into the mouth of hell. I don't envy you.
Now Gaunt smiled.
Just you keep pounding the western hills and keep them busy. In fact, blow them all away to Kingdom Come before we get there.
Deal,
laughed Ortiz.
And don't drop your damn aim, Gaunt added with a threatening chuckle. Remember, you have friends in the valley.
Two vehicles back, Korbeck nodded his thanks as he took the dark, thin cigar his basilisk commander offered.
Durance,
the serpent said, introducing himself.
Charmed,
Korbeck said. The cigar tasted of licorice, but he smoked it anyway. Lower down the hull of the tank, by Korbeck's sprawled feet, the boy Milo was cleaning out the chanters of his Tanith pipe. It wheezed and squealed hoarsely. Durance blanched.
I'll tell you this. When I heard that boy's piping today, that hell note, it almost scared me more than the damn blood cries of the enemy.
Korbeck chuckled.
The pipe has its uses. It rallies us. It spooks the foe. Back home, the forests move and change. The pipes were a way to follow and not get lost.
Where is home?
Durance asked.
Nowhere now,
Korbeck said, and returned to his smoke. On the back armor of another basilisk, hulking Bragg, the biggest of the ghosts, and small, wiry Larkin were dicing with two of the tank's gun crew. Larkin had already won a gold signet ring set with a turquoise skull. Bragg had lost all his smokes and two bottles of sacra. Every now and then, the lurch of the tank beneath them would flip the dice or slide them under an exhaust baffle, prompting groans and accusations of fixing and cheating. Up by the top hatch with the vehicle's commander, Major Rawn watched the game without amusement. The basilisk commander felt uneasy about his passenger. Rawn was slender, dark, and somehow dangerous. A starburst tattoo covered one eye. He was not likable or open like the other ghosts seemed to be.
So, Major, what's your commissar like?
The commander began, by way of easing the silence.
Gaunt?
Rawn asked, turning slowly to face the serpent.
He's a despicable bastard who left my world to die, and one day I will slay him with my own hands.
Oh, said the commander, and found something rather more important to do down below. Ortiz passed Gaunt his flask. The afternoon was going, and they were losing the light. Ortiz consulted a map slate, angling it to show Gaunt.
Navigation puts us about 2 kilometers or so short of Pavis Crossroads. We've made good time. We'll be on it before dark. I'm glad. I didn't want to have to turn on the floods and running lights to continue.
What do we know about Pavis? Gaunt asked.
Last reports were it was held by a battalion of bluebloods. That was at 0500 this morning.
Wouldn't hurt to check, Gaunt mused. There are worse things than rolling into an ambush position at twilight, but not many.
Cluggan! He called down the hull to a big, grey-haired ghost sat with others playing cards.
Sir,
Cluggan said, scrambling back up the rocking basilisk. Sergeant, take 6 men, jump down and scout ahead of the column.
We're 2 kilometers short of this crossroads. Gaunt showed Cluggan the map. Should be clear, but after our tangle with the damn world-eaters, we'd best be sure. Cluggan saluted and slid back to his men. In a few moments they had gathered up their kits and weapons and swung down off the skirt armor onto the track. A moment more, and they had vanished like smoke into the woods.
That is impressive, Ortiz said.
At Pavis Crossroads, the serpents spoke. Stretching their great painted beaks towards the night sky, they began their vast barrage. Bryn Milo cowered in the shadow of a medical chimera, pressing his hands to his ears. He'd seen 2 battles up close, the fall of Tanith Magna and the storming of the citadel on Blackshard, but this was the first time he had ever encountered the sheer numbing wrath of armored artillery. The Ketzok basilisks were dug in along the ridge in a straggled line about 0.5 kilometer long. They were hull down into the grey earth, main weapons swung high, hurling death at the western hills across the valley 9 kilometers away. They were firing at will, a sustained barrage that could, Korbeck had assured him, go on all night. Every second at least 1 gun was sounding, lighting the darkness with its fierce muzzle flash, shaking the ground with its firing and recoil. Pavis Crossroads was a stone obelisk, marking the junction of the Metis Road that ran up the valley from Voltis City and the Meyerwood track that carried on towards the east. The Serpent's armor had rolled in at nightfall, ousting the encamped Bluebloods who held the junction and deploying around the ridgeline looking west. As the first stars began to shine, Ortiz's men began their onslaught. Milo kept his eyes sharp for the Commissar, and when he saw Gaunt striding towards a tented dugout beside the orbital communication stack, accompanied by his senior officers, Milo ran to join them. "My scope," requested Gaunt over the barrage. Milo pulled the Commissar's brass-capped nightscope from his pack, and Gaunt stepped up onto the parapet, scanning out of the dugout. Korbeck leaned up close by him, a thin black tube protruding from his beard. Gaunt glanced round. "What's that thing?" he asked. Korbeck took it out and displayed it proudly. "Cigar. Licorice, no less. Won a box off my gun crate CO, and I think I'm getting a taste for him." "See much?" he added. "I can see the lights of Voltis. Watch fires and shrine lights, mostly. Not so inviting." Gaunt flipped his scope shut and jumped down from the parapet, handing the device back to Milo. The boy had already set up the field map, a glass plate in a metal frame, mounted like an easel on a brass tripod. Gaunt cranked the knurled lever on the side, and the glass slowly lit with bluish light. He dropped in a ceramic slide engraved with the local geography, and then angled the screen to show the assembled men, Korbeck, Rawn, Cluggan, Orca, and the other officers. "Bokore Valley," Gaunt said, tapping the glass viewer with the tip of his long, silver Tanith war knife. As if for emphasis, the nearest basilisk outside fired, and the dugout shook. The field map wobbled, and soil trickled in from the roof. 4 kilometers wide, 12 long, flanked to the west by steep hills where the enemy is well established. At the far end, Voltis City, the old capital of Voltamand. 30-meter curtain walls of basalt, built as a fortress 300 years ago, when they knew the art. The invading Chaos host from off-planet seized it at day one as their main stronghold. The Volpone 50th have spent 6 weeks trying to crack it, but the bastards we met today show the kind of force they've been up against. We'll have a go tonight. He looked up, oblivious to the constant thunder outside. Major Rawn? Rawn stepped forward, almost reluctant to be anywhere near Gaunt. No one knew what had passed between them when they had been alone together on Blackshard, but everyone had seen Gaunt carry Rawn to safety on his shoulder, despite his own injuries. Surely that sort of action bonded men, not deepened their enmity. Rawn adjusted a dial on the field map's edge so that the plate displayed a different section of the chart slide. "The approach is straightforward. The Bokore River runs along the wide valley floor, that is broad and slow-moving, especially at this time of year. Most of the way is choked with bulrushes and waterweed. We can move down the river channel undetected." "You've scouted this?" Gaunt asked. "My squad returned not 30 minutes ago," Rawn said smoothly. "The Bluebloods had tried it a number of times, but they are semi-armored, and the mud was too great an impediment. We are lighter, and we are good." Gaunt nodded. "Korbeck,
The big man sucked on his cigar. His genial eyes twinkled, and it made Milo smile.
We move by dark, of course, in the next half hour. Staggered squads of 30 men to spread out our traces.
He tapped the map screen at another place. Primary point of entry is the old city Watergate. Heavily defended, of course. Secondary squads under Sergeant Cluggum will attempt to storm the wall at the Western Sanitation Outfalls. I won't pretend either way will be a picnic.
Objective, Gorn said. Get inside and open the city. We'll move in squads. One man in every 10 will be carrying as much high explosive as he can. Squad leaders should select any man with demol experience. We provide cover for these demolition specialists to allow them to set charges that will take out sections of wall or gates. Anything that splits the city open. I've spoken to the Blue Blood Colonel. He has several thousand men in motorized units ready to advance and take advantage of any opening we can make. They will be monitoring on Channel 80. The signal will be Thunderhead. There was silence. Silence except for the relentless hammering of the basilisk guns. Form up and move out, Gorn said. Outside, Ortiz stood talking to several of his senior officers, one of them Durans. They saw the ghost officers emerge from the dugout and orders being given. Across the emplacement, Ortiz caught Gaunt's eye. It was too loud for words, so he clenched his fist and rapped it twice against his heart, an old gesture for luck. Gaunt nodded.
Scary men,
Durans said.
I almost feel sorry for the enemy.
Ortiz glanced round at him.
I'm joking, of course,
Durans added, but Ortiz wasn't sure he was. Midnight had seen them waist-deep in the stinking black water of the Bakore River reed beds, assailed by clouds of biting flies. 3 hours' hard trudge through the oily shallows of the old river, and now the sheer walls of Voltis rose before them, lit by cressets and braziers high up. Behind them, like a distant argument, the basilisks spat death up into the heavens, a distant rolling roar and a series of orange flashes on the skyline. Gaunt adjusted his nightscope and panned it round, seeing features in the darkness as a green negative. The water gate was 30 meters across and 40 tall, the mouth of a great chute and adjoining system that returned water to the Bakore once it had driven the mills inside the city. Gaunt knew that somewhere sluices must have been lowered, and the flow staunched, closing off the chute's operation. Sandbagged emplacements could be made out, up in the shadows behind the gate's breastwork. He adjusted his micro-bead link.
Korbeck?
Colm Korbeck heard his commander in the darkness and acknowledged. He waded forward through the reeds to Bragg, who had hunkered down behind a rotting jetty.
When you're ready, Korbeck invited.
Bragg grinned, teeth bright in the starlight. He dragged the canvas cover off one of the 2 huge weapons he had lugged on his shoulders from Pavis Crossroads. The polished metal of the missile launcher had been dulled down with smears of Meyerwood mud. Try again, Bragg, was a spectacularly lousy shot. But the Watergate was a big target, and the missile rack held 4 Melter missiles. The night exploded. 3 missiles went straight up the throat of the chute. The force of the heat blast sent stone debris, metal shards, water vapor, and body parts out in a radius of 50 meters. The 4th vaporized a chunk of wall and brought down a small avalanche of basalt chunks. For a moment, the heat was so intense that Gaunt's nightscope read nothing but emerald glare. Then it showed him the chiseled mouth of the Watergate had become a bubbling, blazing wound in the huge wall, a ragged, slumping incision in the sheer basalt. He could hear agonized screaming from within the chute. Beyond the city wall, alarm bells and sirens rose in pandemonium. The ghosts charged the Watergate. Orca led the 1st squad up the sloping drainaway under the molten arch of ruptured stone. He and 3 of his men swung flamers in wide arcs, scorching and scouring up into the darkness of the echoing chute. Behind them, Korbeck brought in fire teams with las guns who darted down into the side passages and cisterns of the Watergate, butchering the cultists who had limped or crawled into cover after the 1st attack. The 3rd wave went in, under Major Rawn. In the front rank was Bragg, his empty launcher discarded in favor of the heavy bolter that he had liberated from its mounting back on Blackshard,
and now lugged around like a smaller man might heft a heavy rifle. Gaunt leapt forward too, bolt pistol in one hand, chainsword in the other. He bellowed after his attacking men, all of them racing silhouettes backlit against the glittering water by fire. Milo sprang up, fumbling with the Tanith pipes under his arm. "Now would be a good time, Bryn," Gaunt said. Milo found the mouthpiece, inflated the bag, and began to keen an old battle lament of Tanith, the dark path of the forest. Up in the chute, Orca and his squad heard the shrill wail of the pipes outside. Damp darkness was before them.
"Close up,"
Orca snapped into his microbead.
"Aye." "To your left,"
Brith yelled suddenly. An assault cannon raged out of the darkness of a side chute. Brith, Orca, and two others disintegrated instantly into red mist and flesh pulp. Troopers Gades and Kafran ducked back behind the buttress work of the huge vault.
"Enemy fire!" Kafran yelled into his bead. "They have the chute covered in a killing sweep!"
Corbeck cursed. He might have expected this.
"Stay down,"
he ordered the young ghost over the mic, as he beckoned his first two squads up the lower chute, black water swilling around their knees.
"Hell of a foul place for a firefight,"
mourned Mad Larkin, scoping with his lasgun.
"Stow it, Larks,"
Corbeck growled. Ahead they heard the nightmare chatter of the cannon and the added rhythm of drums and guttural chants. Corbeck knew Larkin was right. A tight, confined, unyielding stone tunnel was no place for a serious fight. This was a two-way massacre in the making.
"They're just trying to psych us out,"
he told his ghosts, smoothly, as they edged forward.
"What do you know? That's working,"
Val said. The drums and chanting got louder, but suddenly the cannon shut off.
"It stopped,"
Kafran reported over the link. Corbeck looked round into Larkin's crazed eyes.
"What do you think?
A trick? To lure us out?"
Larkin sniffed the thick air.
"Smell that. Burning ceramite. I'd wager they've got an overheat jam."
Corbeck didn't answer. He cinched his bayonet onto his lasgun and charged up the slope of the chute, screaming louder and shriller than Milo's pipes. In uproar, the ghost squads followed him. Kafran and Gades joined the charge, bellowing, weapons held low as they splashed out from behind the buttress into the main vault. Corbeck leapt clear of a sandbag line, damming one gully, and disemboweled the two cultists who were struggling to unjam the assault cannon. Larkin dropped down on one knee in the brackish soup and popped the cover on his lasgun's darkscope. Carefully selecting his expert long shots, he blasted four cultists further down the chute. Laz and Boltfire slammed back at the ghosts, dropping several of them. The charging guardsmen met the cultist force head-on in a tight, tall subchute, no wider than two men abreast. Bodies exploded, blasted at close range. Bayonets and blades sliced and jabbed. Corbeck was in the thick of it. Already a chainsword had gashed his left hand and cost him a finger, and blood blurted from a slash to his shoulder. He speared a man, but lost his gun when the corpse's weight on the bayonet tore it out of his hands. He ripped out his fallback weapons, a las pistol and his Tanith knife of sheer silver. Around him in the frenzy, men killed or died in a confined press that was packed in close like a busy working transit, crowded at rush hour. Already the water level was rising because of the depth of bodies and body parts in the gully. Corbeck shot a cultist through the head as he was charged, and then lashed sideways with the silver blade, opening a throat.
"For Tanith, first and last and only!"
he screamed. Advancing up the tunnel 50 paces back, Gaunt could hear the sheer tumult of the nightmarish close-quarters fight in the chute. He looked down and saw that the trickle of Bakori river water that ran down over his boots was thick and red. 10 meters further, he found Trooper Gades, part of Orca's original squad. The boy had lost his legs to a chainsword, and the water had carried his twitching form back down the smooth slope of the channel.
"Medic! Dordan! To me!"
Gaunt bellowed, cradling the coughing, gagging Gades in his arms. Gades looked up at his commissar.
"A real close fight, so it is," he said with remarkable clarity. "Packed in like fish in a can. The ghosts will make ghosts tonight."
Then he coughed again. Bloody matter vomited from his mouth. And he was gone. Gaunt stood. Milo had faltered, looking down at Gade's stricken, miserable death.
"Play up," urged Gaunt, and turned to shout down the chute to the ghost main force in the bulrushes. "Advance! Narrow file! For the Emperor and the glory of Tanith!"
With a deafening bellow, Gaunt's ghosts charged forward en masse, breaking down into files of three, surging into the throttling entrance to hell. Up ahead, in the dark, close, smoky killing zone, Rawn slumped against a buttress, splashed in gore, and panted. By his side, Larkin squatted and fired shot after shot into the darkness. Korbek suddenly loomed out of the smoke, a terrible apparition drenched in blood.
"Back," he hissed. "Back down the chute! Sound the retreat!"
"What is it?" Rawn said.
"What's that rumbling?"
Larkin asked, distracted, pressing his ear to the stonework.
"Whole tunnel is vibrating."
"Water," Korbek said grimly. "They've opened the sluices. They're going to wash us out."
The cultists were everywhere. Sergeant Klug and Secondary Expedition Force poured in through the stinking crypts of the Western Sanitation outfalls, and the enemy rose to meet them all around. It was hand to hand, each step of the way won by strength and keen blades. The dark, tight confines of the drainage tunnels were lit by the flashes of las fire, and shots ricocheted from the roof and walls.
"What the hell is that smell?"
Forbin wailed, blasting away down an airless cavity with his las gun.
"What do you think? This is the main sewage drain,"
Brod snapped, a one-eyed man in his 50s.
"Notice how the others get the nice clean water gate."
"Keep it together,"
Cluggan snarled, firing in a wide sweep and cutting down a trio of attacking cultists.
"Forget the smell. It's always been a dirty job."
More heavy fire came their way. Forbin lost his left arm and then the side of his head. Cluggan, Brod, and the others returned fire in the close channel. Cluggan eyed the cultist troops they cut through. Bloated, twisted men in robes that had been white silk before they had been dyed in vats of blood. They had come from off-world, part of the vast host of chaos cultists that had descended like locusts onto Voltamand and destroyed its people. The sigils and runes of the blasphemy Khorne were cut into the flesh of their brows and cheeks. They were well-equipped, with bolters and lasguns and armoured. Cluggan hoped to the sweet dead gods of Tanith that his commissar was faring better. The ghosts staggered and stumbled back from the spewing watergate, through the reed beds, towards the comparative cover of the riverbank. Enemy fire from the walls high above killed dozens, their bodies joining the hundreds swept out, swirling and turning by the torrent of brown water roaring from the watergate. Microbead traffic was frantic with cross-chatter and desperately confused calls. Despite their discipline, the madness of the flight from the water had broken Gaunt's main force into a ragged jumble, scrambling for their lives. Soaked through, furious, Gaunt found himself sheltering by some willows in a scummy riverbend 80 meters from the watergate. With him were Kafran, Val, a corporal called Merrin, and two others. Gaunt cursed. Cultists he could fight. World-eaters, demons, anything. He'd set square with any beast in the cosmos. But 70 million liters of water pressured down through a stone conduit.
"May have lost as many as 40 to the flood," Val said.
He dragged Kafran by the tunic from the water, and the young man could only retch and cough.
"Get a confirmed figure from the squad leaders. I don't want rumours,"
Gaunt snarled, then keyed his own radio link and spoke into his bead.
"Squad leaders, discipline the radio traffic. I want regroup status. Korbek, Rawn."
The channels crackled and a more ordered litany of units and casualties reeled in.
"Korbek?" Gaunt asked. "I'm west of you, sir. On the banks. Got about 90 men with me,"
Korbek's voice hissed back.
"Assessment. Tactical. You can forget the watergate, sir. Once they realized they couldn't hold us out in a straight fight, they blew the sluices. It could run at flood for hours. By then they'll have the chute exits on the city side sewn up with emplacements, maybe even mines."
Gaunt cursed again. He wiped a wet hand across his face. They'd been so close, and now it was all lost. Voltis would not be his.
"Sir," Merrin called to him. The corporal was listening to other frequencies on his bead.
"Channel 80. The word has just been given."
Gaunt crossed to him, adjusting his own setting.
"What?"
"The word. Thunderhead."
Merrin said, confused.
Source that signal,
Gaunt snapped. If someone thinks that's a joke, I'll... He got no further. The blast was so loud, it almost went beyond sound. The shockwave mashed into them, chopping the water like a white squall. A kilometer away, a 100-meter section of the curtain wall blew out, ripping a vast wound in the city's flank. Burning, raw, exposed. The channels went mad with frenzied calls and whoops. Gaunt looked on in disbelief. Korbach's voice cut through, person to person on the link.
"It's Cloggan, sir. The old bastard got his boys into the sanitation outfalls, and they managed to dump all of their high X into a treatment system under the walls. Blew the crap out of the cultists."
"So I saw, Colonel," Gaunt said wryly.
"I mean it literally, sir,"
Korbach crackled innocuously.
"It was Cloggan sent the signal. We may have lost the fight to take the Watergate, but Cloggan has won us the battle."
Gaunt slumped back against a tree bole, up to his waist in the stinking river. Around him, the men were laughing and cheering. Exhaustion swept over him, and then he, too, began to laugh. General Sturm took breakfast at 9. The stewards served him toasted black bread, sausage, and coffee. He read a stack of data slates as he ate, and the message caster on the sideboard behind him chattered and dealt out a stream of orbital deployment updates.
"Good news," said Gilbert, entering with a coffee and a message slate in hand. "The best, in fact. Seems your gamble paid off. These ghost fellows have taken Voltis, broken it wide out. Our attack units followed them in en masse. Colonel Maglin says the city will be cleansed by nightfall."
Sturm dabbled his mouth with a serviette.
"Send transmissions of congratulations and encouragement to Maglin and Gaunt's mob. Where are they now?"
Gilbert eyed his slate and helped himself to a sausage from the dish.
"Seems they've pulled out, moving back to Pavis Crossroads along the eastern side of the Bacore Valley."
Sturm set down his silver cutlery and started to type into his memo slate.
"The greater half of our work here is accomplished, thanks to Gaunt,"
he told the intrigued Gilbert.
"Now we thank him. Send these orders under extreme encryption to the CO of the Ketzok Basilisks at Pavis. Without delay, Gilbert."
Gilbert took the slate.
"I say," he began.
Sturm fixed him with a stare.
"There are dangerous cultist units fleeing along the eastern side of the valley, aren't there, Gilbert? Why, you've just read me the intelligence reports that confirm it."
Gilbert began to grin.
"So I did, sir."
Colonel Ortiz snatched the radio from his comm officer and yelled,
"This is Ortiz. Yes, I know, but I expressly query the last orders we received. I realize that, but I don't care. No, I... Listen to me. Oh, General. Yes, I see. I see, sir. No, sir. Not for a moment. Of course, for the glory of the Emperor, sir. Art is out."
He sank back against the metal flank of his basilisk.
"Make the guns ready," he told his officers. "In the name of the Emperor, make them ready."
The guns had been silent for 10 hours. Ortiz hoped he would never hear them blaze again. Dawn frosted the horizon with light. Down in the valley and in the blue blood emplacements, victory celebrations continued with abandon. Durans ran over to Ortiz and shook him.
"Look, sir,"
he babbled.
"Look!"
Men were coming up the Metis Road out of the valley towards them. Tired men, weary men, filthy men, walking slowly, carrying their dead and wounded. They were a straggled column that disappeared back into the morning mist.
"In the name of mercy,"
Ortiz stammered. All around, shocked, silent basilisk crew were leaping down from their machines and going to meet the battered men, supporting them, helping them, or simply staring in appalled disbelief. Ortiz walked over to meet the arrival. He saw the tall figure in the long coat, now ragged, striding wearily out of the mist. Ibram Gaunt was half carrying a young ghost whose head was a bloody mess of bandages. He stopped in front of Ortiz and let medics take the wounded ghost from him.
"I won't,"
Ortiz began. Gaunt's fist silenced him.
"He's here,"
Gilbert said with an insouciant smirk. Sturm got to his feet and straightened his jacket.
"Bring him in," he said.
Colonel Commissar Ibrahim Gaunt marched into the study. He stood, glowering at Sturm and his adjutant.
"Gaunt," Sturm said, "you opened the way for the Royal Volpone. Good show. I hear Chantar turned a melter on himself."
He paused and absently tapped at a data slate on his desk.
"But then this business with... what's his name?"
"Ortega, sir,"
Gilbert said helpfully.
"Ortiz,"
Gaunt corrected.
"The Ketzok fellow. Striking a fellow officer. That's a shooting offence, and you know it, Gaunt. Won't have it. Not in this army. No, sir."
Gaunt breathed deeply. "Despite knowing our position and line of retreat, the artillery unit pounded the eastern flanks of the Bakori Valley for 6 hours straight. They call the phenomenon friendly fire. But I can tell you when you're in the target zone with nothing but twigs and dust for cover, it's nothing like friendly. I lost nearly 300 men, another 200 injured. Amongst the dead was Sergeant Cluggan, who had led the second prong of my assault and whose actions had actually won us the city."
"Bad show indeed,"
Sturm admitted.
"But you must learn to expect this kind of loss, Gaunt. This is war."
He tossed the data slate aside.
"Now, this hitting business, chain of command and all that, my hands are tied. It's to be a court-martial."
Gaunt was level and unblinking.
"If you're going to shoot me for it, get on with it. I struck Ortiz in the heat of the moment. In hindsight, I realize he was probably following orders. Some damn fool orders from HQ.
"Now look, you jumped up," Gilbert began, stepping forward.
"Would you like me to demonstrate what I did to Ortiz?"
Gaunt asked the bigger man acidly.
"Silence, both of you," snarled Sturm. "Commissar Gaunt, Colonel Commissar, I take my duty seriously, and that duty is to enforce the discipline and rule of War Master Makarov, and through him the beloved Emperor himself, strictly and absolutely. The Imperial Guard is based upon the towering principles of respect, authority, unswerving loyalty, and total obedience. Any aberration, even from an officer of your stature, is to be..." "What the hell is that noise?"
He crossed to the window. What he saw made him gawp speechlessly. The basilisk tank thundering up the drive was dragging part of the main gate after it and scattering gourdcocks and drilling bluebloods indiscriminately in its path. It slewed to a halt on the front lawn, demolishing an ornamental fountain in a spray of water and stone. A powerful man in the uniform of a serpent colonel leapt down and strode for the main entrance to the house. His face was set and mean, swollen with bruises down the left side. A door slammed. There was some shouting, some running footsteps. Another slamming door. Some moments later, an aide edged into the study, holding out a data slate for Sturm.
"Colonel Ortiz has just filed an incident report. He suggested you saw it at once, sir."
Gilbert snatched it and read it hastily.
"It seems that Major Ortiz wishes to make it clear he was injured by his own weapon's recoil during the recent bombardment."
Gilbert looked up at Sturm with a nervous laugh.
"That means..."
"I know what it means,"
Sturm snapped. The general glared at Gaunt, and Gaunt glared right back, unblinking.
"I think you should know," Gaunt said, low and deadly. "It seems that callous murder can be committed out here in the lawless war zones, and the fact of it can be hidden by the confusion of war. You should bear that in mind, General, sir."
Sturm was lost for words for a moment. By the time he had remembered to dismiss Gaunt, the Commissar had already gone.
"Oh, for Feth's sake, play something more cheerful," Korbeck said from his troopship bunk, flexing his bandaged hand.
He was haunted by the ghost of his missing finger. Appropriate, he thought. In the bunk below him, Milo squeezed the bladder of his pipes and made them let out a moan, a shrill, sad sigh. It echoed around the vast troop bay of the huge, ancient starship, where 1,000 Tanith ghosts were billeted in bunks. The dull rhythm of the warp engines seemed to beat in time to the wailing pipes.
"How about you and Fairlow's march?"
Milo asked. Above him, Korbeck smiled, remembering the old jig, and the nights he heard it played in the taverns of Tanith Magna.
"That would be very fine," he said.
The energetic skip of the jig began and quickly snaked out across the iron mesh of the deck, between the aisles of bunks, around stacks of kits and camo cloaks, through the smoky groups where men played cards or drank, over bunks where others slept or secretly gazed at portraits of women and children who were forever lost and tried to hide their tears. Enjoying the tune, Corbeck looked up from his bunk when he heard footsteps approach down the deck plates. He jumped up when he saw it was Gaunt. The commissar was dressed as he had first met him, 50 days before, in high-waisted dress breeches with leather braces, a sleeveless undershirt, and jackboots. "Sir," Corbeck said, surprised. The tune faltered, but Gaunt smiled and waved Milo on. "Keep playing, lad. It does us good to hear your merrier tunes." Gaunt sat on the edge of Milo's bunk and looked up at Corbeck. "Voltamand is credited as a victory for the Volpone Bluebloods," he told his number two frankly, "because they seized the city. Sturm mentions our participation with commendations in his report. But this one won't win us our world." "Feth take 'em," spat Corbeck. "There will be other battles. Count on it." "I'm afraid I do, sir," Corbeck smiled. Gaunt bent down and opened the kit bag he was carrying. He produced a half dozen bottles of sacra. "In the name of all that's good and holy," Corbeck said, jumping down from his bunk. "Where?" "I am an Imperial Commissar," Gaunt said. "I have pull. Do you have glasses?" Chuckling, Corbeck pulled a stack of old shot glasses from his kit. "Call Bragg over. I know he likes this stuff," Gaunt said. "And Varl and Merrin, Madvarkin, Sooth, young Kafran. Hell's teeth, why not Major Rawn, too? And one for the boy. There's enough to share. Enough for everyone." He nodded down the companionway to the three bewildered naval officers who were approaching with a trolley laden with wooden crates.
"What do we drink to?" Corbeck asked.
"To Sergeant Cluggan and his boys. To victory. And to the victories we are yet to have."
"Drink to revenge, too,"
Milo said quietly from his bunk, setting down his pipes. Gaunt grinned.
"Yes, that too. You know, I've got just the treat to go with this fine brew," Corbeck announced, searching his pockets. "Cigars, licorice flavor."
He broke off. What he had pulled from his coat pocket had ceased to be cigars a good while before. They were a matted, frayed, waterlogged mess. Corbeck shrugged and grinned, his eyes twinkling, as Gaunt and the others laughed.
"Ah, well," he sighed philosophically. "Some you win."
Heavy, spoon-billed wading birds flew west across the lines, white against the encroaching dark. In the thickets, the daytime chirruping insects gave up their pitches to the night beetles, the nocturnal crickets, the tick flies, creatures that spiraled and swam in the light of the stove fires and filled the long hot darkness with their percussion. Other cries rolled in the sweaty air, the whoops and gurgles of unseen climbers and grazers in the swamp. The distant artillery had fallen silent. Gaunt returned to the command shed just as the grill-shaded watch lights came on, casting their greenish glow downwards into the slush, bullseye covers damping their outflung light in any direction other than down. No sense in making a long-range target of the base. Furry, winged insects the size of chubby hands flew in at once to bounce persistently off the lit grills with a dull, intermittent thock, thock, thock. Gaunt took one last look around the base side, now distinguished only by the points of light, the cook fires, stoves, watch lights, and moving torches. He sighed and went inside. The command center was long and low, with a roof of galvanized corrugate and walls of double-ply flakboard. The floor was fresh-cut local wood, sawn into planks and treated with vile-smelling lacquer. Blast shutters on the windows stood half open, and the wire screens inside them were already thick with a fuzzy, quivering residue, the mangled bodies of moths and night bugs which had thrown themselves at the mesh. Gaunt's command equipment and his duffel bags of personal effects were set off the floor on blocks of wood. They'd been sat directly on the floor for the first 2 days until it was discovered that where damp didn't seep up, burrowing worms did. He draped his coat on a wire hanger and hung it from a nail on the overhead rafter, then pulled up a camp chair and sat down heavily. Before him, block mounted, sat a cogitator, a Vox uplink, and a flat-screen mimeograph. A tech priest had spent over an hour diligently intoning prayers of function as he made the sacred machines ready. They were still propped in their half-open wrought iron casings to protect against the damp, and thick power feeds snaked off from them and ran from clip supports on the rafters out of a socket shutter and off to the distant generator. Lights and light images shimmered and flickered on glass plates glossed by condensation. Setting dials throbbed a dull orange. The Vox link made a low-level serpent hiss as it rose and fell through frequencies. Gaunt leaned forward and idly surveyed the latest information and tactical data coming through from the orbital fleet and other units. A skein of coded runes crossed and blinked on the dark glass. Quiet as nightfall, Milo entered from the anteroom. He offered a pewter beaker to his commissar. Gaunt took it with a nod, delighting at the beaded coolness of the metal.
"The tech priest's got the cooling units working again just now,"
Milo muttered by way of explanation.
"For a few minutes. It's only water, but it's cold."
Gaunt nodded his appreciation and sipped. The water was metallic and sharp, but it was deliciously cool. There was a thump on the outside step, then a quiet knock at the door. Gaunt smiled. The thump had been deliberate, a reassuring advance warning from a man who made no sound if he did not wish to. "Come in, McCall," Gaunt said. McCall entered, his lined face a little quizzical, as if surprised at being recognized in advance.
"Patrol report, sir," he said, standing stiffly in the doorway.
Gaunt gestured him to a seat. McCall's battle dress and cloak were drenched in wet mud. Everything, including his face, was splattered. Everything except his lasgun, miraculously clean.
"Let's have it." "Their positions are still far back," McCall began. "Beyond the offensive line coded Alpha Pink. A few forward patrols."
"Trouble?" The powerful, wiry man grimaced noncommittally.
"Nothing we couldn't handle."
"I've always admired your modesty," Gaunt said. "But I need to know." McCall screwed up his mouth and nose.
"We took 6 of them in the western swamps. No losses on our side."
Gaunt nodded approval. He liked McCall, the Tanith's finest scout. Even in a regiment of stealthers and covert warriors, McCall was exceptional. A woodsman back home on Lost Tanith, he had reconnaissance skills that had proved themselves time and again to the ghosts. A ghost amongst ghosts, and modest with it. He never bragged, and it was certain he had more to brag about than most. Gaunt offered his beaker to the man.
"Thank you, sir, no."
McCall looked down at his hands.
"It's cold," Gaunt assured him. "I can tell. But no, I'd rather go without something I could get used to."
Gaunt shrugged and sipped again.
"So they're not moving?"
"Not yet.
We sighted I'm not sure what it was, an old ruin of some kind."
McCall rose and pointed to a position on the wall chart.
"Around here, far as I can tell.
Could be nothing, but I'd like to follow it through with a survey in the morning."
"An enemy position?"
"No, sir. Something that was already here."
"You're right. Deserves a look."
"In the morning, then,"
Gaunt agreed.
"If that'll be all, sir."
"Dismissed, McCall."
"I'll never get the measure off him,"
Gaunt said to Milo after McCall had left. "Quietest man I've ever known."
"That's what he does, isn't it, sir?"
Milo said.
"What?"
"Quiet."
Part 3. Sound and Fury. All around there was a hushing sound, as if the whole world wanted to silence him. McCall bellied in low amid the forest of ferns, trying to pick through the oceanic rushing sound they made as the wind stirred them. The fern growth in that part of Ramillies 268-43, flourishing on the thin ashy soils of the long cold volcanic slopes, was feathery and fibrous, mottled stalks rough as cane rising 3 man heights into swaying multi-part fronds as white as water ice. They reminded him of the Nullwood forests back home, when there was still a back home. The Nullwoods in winter, when he'd gone out logging and hunting. Frost had crusted the evergreen needles on the sighing trees then, until they had tinkled like wind chimes. Here, now, there was only the sigh,
the motion of the dry ferns, and the clogging dust that got into every pore and rasped the soft tissue at the back of the throat. The sunlight was bright and harsh, stabbing down through the pale, spare air out of a sky translucent blue. It made a striated web out of the ground cover under the ferns, stark sun splashes and jagged shadows of blackness. He crept forward 20 meters into a break of skeleton brush. His lower legs were already double-wrapped with chain-cloth to protect against the shredding thorns. He had his lasgun held to his chest on a tightly cinched strap to keep it clear of the dust, but every 10 minutes or so he checked its moving parts and cleared the dust, fern fibers, twig shreds, and burrs that accumulated constantly. Several cracks made him turn and freeze, sliding his gun into a firing grip between smooth, dry palms. Something was moving through the thicket to his left, cracking the occasional spent thorn underfoot. To be fair, they were moving with extreme and trained stealth, but still their progress sounded like a careless march to McColl's acute hearing. McColl drew his knife, its long silver blade deliberately dulled with ash. He backed into a thorn stalk and molded his body to the kinking plant. 2 steps. 1. He swung out, only pulling back his blade at the last moment. Trooper Dewar cried out and fell backwards, splintering dry stalks as he dropped. McColl was on top of him in a second, pinning his arms and pushing the blade against his neck.
"Sacred Feth, you could have killed me!"
Dewar barked agitatedly.
"Yes, I could," said McColl, a whisper.
He relaxed his grip, rolled off, and let the man rise.
"So could anything else out here, noise you are making."
"I?" Dewar dropped his voice suddenly.
"Are we alone?"
McColl didn't answer. Chances were, if anything else was out here, it would have heard Dewar's fall too.
"I didn't mean anything,"
Dewar began hoarsely, wincing as he plucked out the thorns he had fallen on. McColl was scanning around, his gun ready.
"What the feth did they teach you during basic?" he whispered. "You're meant to be a scout."
Dewar didn't reply. All the scouts knew McColl's exacting standards and knew just as well how they all failed to meet them. Dewar felt angry, in fact. During basic training, before that as a hunter in the southern game land of Tanith Attica, he'd been reckoned as a good tracker. That was why they had selected him for the scout unit when the regiment mustered for Feth's sake. And this old bastard made him feel like a fool. A clumsy fool. Wordlessly, ignoring the stare he knew Dewar was boring into the back of his head, McColl signalled an advance, heading down the slope into the fern-choked vale. The Tanith had arrived on Ramillies 2 weeks before, just in time to miss the main action. The Adeptus Astartes had cleaned out and secured the 4 enemy strongholds, banishing chaos from the world. The ghosts had assembled on the low plains near one burning fortress, seeing space marines, threatening bulks, in the smoky distance, like the giants of myth, piling the ragged corpses of slain cultists onto pyres. The air had been thick with filthy char. It seemed some small components of the enemy had fled the defeat, making into the fern forests in the north, too small and insignificant for the glorious space marines to waste time upon. The commissar was charged with a search and destroy detail. The ghosts had advanced into the low hills and the dense forestation to smoke out the last of the foe. There were a few early successes. Enclaves of cultists, some well-armed, dug into bolt holes and lodges, making a last stand. Then, after a week, as they reached the colder, higher plateau and the real thickness of the fern cover, a working pattern developed. McColl would plan recon sweeps each day, deploying a couple of dozen scouts in a wide fan into the thickets. They would quarter each area and report back, signalling in the main ghost forces if contact was made. Perhaps they had become lazy, complacent. Major Rawn averred that they had silenced the last of the enemy and were now wasting their time and patience, cutting deeper and deeper into the lonely territories of the hinterland. The commissar himself seemed devoted to discharging the task properly, but even he had doubled the reach and range of the scout sweeps. Another few days and they would quit, he had told McColl. This day, this high, cold, windy day, with the ever-present whisper of the ferns, the scouts had gone deeper and wider into the hills.
There had been no contact with anything for 2 whole sweeps. McCall sensed that the less dedicated troopers like Dewar were getting slack with the routine. But he himself had seen things that kept him sharp and made him determined to press on. Things he had reported to Gaunt to convince him to work the forests a little longer. Broken paths in the vegetation, trampled areas, torn, apparently random trails in the underbrush. There was something still out here. They crossed the valley floor and came up the shaded side, where the ferns listed restlessly, like shadow fans. Every dozen or so steps, Dewar's feet cracked a thorn or a seed case or chinked a rock, no matter how delicately he walked. He cursed every sound. He was determined to prove his ability to McCall, and he had no clue how McCall moved so silently, like he was floating. The ferns hissed in the wind. McCall stopped to check his compact chart and referred his eyes to sun and compass. Within a quarter of an hour, their circuit should bring them into contact with Rafael and Wade, on a mirror sweep towards them. McCall suddenly held up a hand, and Dewar stopped sharp. The scout sergeant fanned his fingers twice to indicate Dewar should cover, and the other slid in low beside a thick fern stem, knelt, and raised his lasgun. There was dust on the exchanger, and he wiped it off. Dust in his eyes, too, and he wiped them. He braced and then took aim, rolling it left and right as McCall advanced. McCall dropped down another few meters and found another torn trail in the fern.